Monster Man, special episode, Bears. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Chris. If you'd like to be like Chris and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Chris, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Chris has asked me to talk about bears, specifically folkloric bears, the roles that bears play in the myths and legends of different cultures. He mentioned being inspired by the scary bear in the Disney film Brave, which I have seen, but I don't really remember other than that. Aren't there some princes who get turned into bears? I think that's right. And also the bear-like monster in The New Mutants, which is a projection of Danielle Moonstar's Darkest Fears or something. It's been a long time since I read the Demon Bear Saga, and I did watch the film recently, but I would hesitate to say that I was fully engaged by it. But these two examples of monstrous bears are very interesting to me, because bears are still popular monsters in media, but they are unusually an animal which can be either a protagonist, so Brother Bear or Wee Bear Bears, or an antagonist, as in the films I mentioned, or like The Revenant, or something like Cocaine Bear, which I saw earlier this month. I don't think that's very common. If you look at, say, dogs, the ratio of films where a dog is a hero as opposed to where a dog is a villain has got to be like 100-1. And if you look at sharks, it's got to be like 100-1 the other way. There are other animals which have escaped a strict good guy, bad guy binary. Lions would be another obvious example where there are movies where, you know, a lion is the protagonist, like The Lion King, but there are also movies where a lion is the antagonist, like that one with Val Kilmer. Was that The Ghost in the Darkness? And then there's like the one with Idris Elba where he's like in the car and the lions are attacking him. But it's rare. Typically, animals are either good guys or bad guys. And it isn't the case that bears are like anti-heroes. When you have a bear protagonist, they're usually a cheerful, friendly sort. It's not that they have the qualities of a villainous bear, they're just a good guy. So bears are very versatile. They appear in a wide range of different roles. And that is as true in folklore as it is in media. So we're going to take a look at some myths and legends from cultures that live around bears, and they have some similarities. This has led folklorists sometimes to be a little excitable and assume shared kind of prehistoric origins. And there is some evidence that very early humans thought that bears were very important. Bears obviously probably a much bigger part of their day-to-day lives than they are for us today, but there was some evidence for ritual treatment of bear remains, bear skins, bear skulls, things like that, quite early on. And this may be something to do with an image that recurs in a lot of these legends, which is that bears are kind of human-like. Not to say that they look like people necessarily, but I think you don't have to observe a bear for long before you start to see some aspects of its behavior that might feel a little familiar. And also, as omnivores, bears are not unlikely to approach human settlements in search of food. This is particularly true in the modern day, where human settlement has encroached on the bear's habitats to a great extent, and also depleted other sources of food within those habitats. So this has given humans a lot of opportunity to observe bears, you know, maybe more than any other, like, comparably large or dangerous animal. And this may sort of account for their unusual status. One common belief about bears is that it is a bad idea to name them. This shows up in a few different cultures, especially in Northern Europe, but it's also found, I believe, in Asia, like it's found in sort of Siberia and places like that. This is the kind of thing that led Hilda Ellis Davison to propose that sort of circumpolar cultures have something in common with each other, maybe more so than Northern and Southern cultures within Europe or Asia. Not sure I agree with that, but never mind. But this notion that it is bad luck to say the bear's name, or that it will attract bears if you do it. We've talked about this before, because it's in the Finnish mythology section of Patron Deities. My leading example of this comes from the Kalevala, the Finnish national epic poem compiled in the 19th century by Elias Lönnrot. And in the Kalevala, Väinämöinen uses about a billion different euphemisms for bear. So I'm going to read you some extracts from the Kalevala. This is a translation by Keith Bosley. This is an Oxford University Press edition. So in this section, Louhi, who's kind of the bad guy of the story, has summoned or created the bear, and Väinämöinen sets out to hunt it on the pretext that he is just going to visit the forests. Before going, he sort of prays to the spirits or gods of the forest. He says, "Take me, forest, for one of your men, for one of your fellows, Tapio," Tapio being the god of the forest. "Help me to have luck, to fell the forest's fair one. Mieliki, forest mistress, Tellervo, Tapio's wife, tie your dog up tight, and put up your cur in a honeysuckle lane in an oaken frame." And then, from here, he addresses the bear itself. "Beast, apple of the forest, chunky honey paw, when you hear me coming, a real man stepping, tie your claws up in your fur, your teeth in your gums, so that they never touch me when you make a lunge. My beastie, my matchless one, honey paw, my handsome one, slump down upon a hummock, upon a fair rock with pines swaying overhead, spruces rustling overhead. There, beast, circle round and round, honey paw, turn round and round, like the grouse upon its nest, the goose upon its brood." He puts the bear to sleep with this incantation, and then, having killed the bear, the poem goes on. "He looks at his golden one. He uttered a word, spoke thus, 'My beastie, my matchless one, honey paw, my handsome one, don't be angry without cause. It was not I that felled you. You rolled off the collar bow yourself, toppled off the log, tearing your wooden breeches, splitting your pine coat. Autumn weather slippery and the cloudy days are dark. Golden forest cuckoo, fair one with fur luxuriant, leave your home cold now, the land where you live empty, your home of birch boughs, your abode of basket twigs. Go, famous one, on your way. Pride of the forest, step out. Get moving, nimble of shoe, blue of stocking, on tiptoe, from these little yards, these narrow alleys, to be among the fellows, to be in a crowd of men. No one there is ill-treated, nor made to live like a wretch. Mead is fed there. Fresh honey is given to drink to the guest who comes, to the would-be visitor. Go now from here, after all, from this little den, and go under the famous roof-beam, under the fair roof. Float upon the snow like water-lily on a pool. Flit upon a sprig like a squirrel on a bough." And then there's a whole ceremony when he brings the bear's pelt back. So a lot of respect or even flattery given to the spirit of the bear in this example. And I think that that's not uncommon. A similar attitude to bear hunting exists in some Native American culture. So for example, Cree bear hunting rituals are very detailed and they cover everything from like the clothes that the hunter is supposed to wear to how the meat is to be shared to how the community is supposed to dispose of the bones. So you can't just like throw the bones of a bear away like you would with any other meat because it would be disrespectful for dogs to get at them, so you have to hang them from a tree until they're excarnated. It's a whole thing. So this idea that hunting a bear is a special big deal, you know, we can think of as a ritual reflection of the actual practical challenges involved in hunting a large, dangerous mammal. Okay, myth number two, bears as people. A common motif is the idea of bears as sort of interacting with humans, often in a human way. So for example, there's a story in Eastern Shoshone folklore, which is about a man who is like out in the woods and he comes across a group of bears performing a sun dance, and they've like painted a tree and done all these other things that you're supposed to do with the sun dance. And to me, this sort of reflects the idea that bears do have kind of dance-like behaviors. You know, we can see when bears walk on their hind legs that sometimes they do have this slightly, you know, they sort of wobble from side to side. They have this dance-like step. Not that I think that particularly looks like a sun dance, but one can imagine how the idea of bears doing human things kind of naturally suggests itself. The Tsimshian people of Alaska and British Columbia have a story about a meeting of the animals where the animals are trying to decide what to do about humans and specifically how long is winter going to be. And this meeting eventually is going to end up with, you know, winter being for part of the year and then summer being for part of the year. And it's kind of this is why bears hibernate. But the important thing for our purposes is that the ruler of the animals, the kind of like chair of this meeting, is grizzly bear. Although it is not grizzly bear who makes the final decision, but wily porcupine. Or another story from the northwest of North America from the Haida Nation, from Haida Gwaii in British Columbia, tells the story of a young woman who marries a bear, indeed the chief of bears, and learns a special song from him. Even when she returns to her people, she can go into the wood and sing the song to get help from her former husband. Although there are versions of this story in which the woman's brothers kill the bear, so they're not all about like having this good relationship between bears and humans. And in fact, there's a sort of marginality to this because the young woman has run off into the reason that she's living in the woods and not like with the rest of the community is that she's in sort of a forbidden relationship. She loves this young man whom she's been prohibited to marry. And so at one point he goes back into town and is sort of persuaded to return, I think. And when he goes to look for her to bring her back as well, he finds that she's run off to be with the bears or has been abducted. I think this is one of those examples where the bear thing's not really what's supposed to be important about the story. So there are aspects of it that are not very detailed. Or maybe it's just a retelling I have, which is from, I want to say, Richard Erdos and Alfonso Ortiz's Native American Myths and Legends, or American Indian Myths and Legends. So one image that comes up in a lot of modern discussions of bears and like spirituality or folklore is the idea that there's something magical about bears because of hibernation, that they become a symbol of death and rebirth, that just as the bear wakes up after the winter, so the dead person will wake up after some period of death. That makes sense. I can't find as many original sources for it as I can find sort of New Age discussions of it. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist. I just think modern readers consider different aspects of these stories to be important, perhaps, let's say. By contrast, one thing that is more important, I guess we can call this myth number three. By contrast, one thing that is important to many historical cultures is this idea of bear ancestry. So, for instance, I mentioned that Haida story about the young woman. Well, she has kids with the bear, and they come back and live with the Haida, and everything's perfectly normal. There are also a number of ancient Greek heroes who are nurtured by bears, a bit like Romulus and Remus being raised by a wolf. The Ainu nation of Japan, right? So kind of the ethnic group from northern Japan, especially Hokkaido, but also there are small groups outside Japan in Siberia and whatnot, claim descent from a brown bear. And there was at least one 11th century Anglo-Danish nobleman who also claimed descent, I think from a polar bear, or at least that was later said of him. I mentioned the Ainu. You know, the bear deity or spirit is such an important part of Ainu religious belief that I have seen the Ainu religion or the Ainu spirituality described as arctolatry, bear worship. And in fact, some of their religious practices were controversial in Japan because they violated Japan's laws against animal cruelty because they did practice animal sacrifice, specifically bear sacrifice. But this whole process that lasted years of raising this bear and kind of like the idea being that you get blessings from looking after it, but then you kill it and send it back to the spirit world or something like that. But there was a court case, and now I believe that the rite is allowed as long as it is practiced such and such times in such and such ways. Part of a cultural exemption to Japan's animal cruelty laws. I mentioned that name Arctos. Of course, that is just Greek for bear, right? Arctolatry, bear worship. And I can't talk about bear heroes without mentioning someone whose name is connected to Arctos, Arthur. Although I will say that Arthur does not otherwise really possess bear-like qualities. Unless you want to take the Once in a Future King thing, which of course a later addition to the Arthurian concept, as being bear-like. We're not concerned about cultural authenticity. We're allowed to mix and match because we're creating a fantasy here. Now, so far, most of the bears that we have looked at in our study of bear myths have been pretty positive, right? We've got bears as magical helpers, bears as nurturers of heroes. Even the bear in the Kalevala is understood as a threat, but I don't think there's any suggestion that the bear is evil. It's just a bear. However, there are beliefs in monstrous bears, and one of those is found in England, and that is the headless bear. There are a surprising number of references to headless bears in 16th and 17th century English sources. So, for example, there's a headless bear listed as a bogey in A Midsummer Night's Dream, where I believe it's one of the things that Puck says he can transform himself into or appear as. It also appears in Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy. It's famously illustrated in the 1584 pamphlet A True and Most Dreadful Discourse. If you've seen that sort of woodcut of a headless bear menacing someone, I think, in bed, that comes from The True and Most Dreadful Discourse, which has one of those old-timey titles that is much longer, but I don't have it written down. It turns up in other places as well. So, for example, there's a 17th century account where a soldier says that he once saw the headless bear. And I got that from the book The Lore of the Land, and the authors there contend that headlessness is a feature of a lot of ghost stories simply as a way of indicating that the thing is dead. So, for example, there's a black dog story that says that the dog has no head and also glowing eyes, which is like, well, that would be impossible if you were meant to take this as a literal description, which you're not. You're meant to understand that by headless, they just mean like, oh, we're talking about a bogey. One of the interesting things about the headless bear is that it's an example of a monster which actually kind of loses some of its source of terror, so it's much less viscerally frightening than a regular bear. If I was being attacked by a bear, the head would be one of the main things I'd be worried about. But the headless bear is more conceptually frightening, because if you don't have a head, you're really not supposed to be going around scaring people. I wonder if there's a connection between a headless bear and a bear skin. Because one can imagine, you know, if you're in like a hunting environment, you have the head of the bear mounted on a wall, well, that must mean that there's a bear's body out there without a head attached to it, that there's a bear's skin without the bear head on top. So perhaps the headless bear is looking for its head, or perhaps it's just a bear skin concealing, you know, three goblins or whatever. I do think it's interesting that these come from an era where bear baiting was a pastime, right? That this idea of setting dogs on a bear in a horrid spectator blood sport. So I wonder if there's perhaps some sense that bears are rather hard done by in this society. I think it's notable that these, I don't know if there's a comparable bogey from other parts of the world, but I do think that it's interesting that the headless bear comes from apparently primarily England, which of course doesn't especially have bears. Bears have been extinct in England for, I mean, like, since antiquity. Well, I don't know. It's not like wolves where they go extinct in the Middle Ages. They've been gone for a long time. When you find bears in England, those bears have been imported in the sort of medieval and early modern periods. More practically menacing bear monsters appear in other mythologies. So, for example, there's an Aleut story of a greedy hunter. He was too successful of a hunter, which is basically this idea that he was kind of overtaxing the landscape. And he was essentially, as a punishment, transformed into a bear, and now he uses his like greed to hunt people. And so I guess the moral of the story is sort of like, how would you like it if it happened to you? Like, people, you over hunt the environment. So what if other things that hunted also hunted too much? You wouldn't like that, would you? So okay, in games, I think this means the bears can play several roles, in addition to the usual like forest random encounter or druidic pal. I like the idea of the bear as a threat in the forest that has to be warded against by the correct rituals. If you sing the right song, you can put the bear to sleep. If you do the ritual before hunting in the correct manner, then the bear's spirit will not be displeased. This seems like a good way to deploy the kind of like arrogant city folk. So, you know, you have the village and they've lived on the edge of the woods for forever and they know all the bear rights. But then like some rich big game hunter comes and he won't listen to these superstitious primitives or follow their ritual. And therefore, he runs into bear trouble. And then his, you know, rich aunt hires you, the adventurers, to go and rescue him. The unsympathetic person who doesn't know to say honey paw and doesn't care to learn, but nonetheless probably doesn't deserve to be eaten by a bear, is always fun for me. I don't know why. I guess because it gives characters an opportunity to disagree about the morality of their actions. Whereas, you know, if you're rescuing like a lovely princess who gives to the poor and wants to resist the Dark Lord, everyone just thinks, oh yeah, that's a nice lady and she deserves to be rescued. Or like if it's an adorable child, everyone agrees that an adorable child needs to be rescued. And everyone agrees that some like sneering monster of a tycoon or evil general doesn't need to be rescued. But what if this is somebody who's like basically a normal person, but just kind of a jerk? That person we can disagree about. I do think that the idea of bears as nurturing would be a fun character origin story. Could be for an antagonist. This is the guy so fierce he was raised by bears. Could also be a thing you could have for like a barbarian's background, that they were raised by bears. I think that could be funny. The Headless Bear seems like a good ghost antagonist, especially for an early modern setting like Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, or something like Maelstrom, which is that kind of like Elizabethan setting, or Seventh Sea, I guess. I feel like there we're seeing the bear more as a creature of the human world than as a creature of the forest. If you're doing like the Vainamoinen bear, Vainamoinen is going into the woods, and that's a big deal. You know, even though he's mythic creator figure, he is a creature of the civilized world, and he knows he's entering someone else's territory when he goes into the woods. He can go there, but he recognizes that it's not really where he belongs. Whereas I feel like the Headless Bear is about the bear being in the world of humans. So it is an outside creature. I think there's a very different feeling to it. I wonder if demon bears are especially frightening because we don't think of bears as malevolent. I mean, the demon bear in The New Mutants is especially frightening because Bill Sienkiewicz draws the heck out of it, which is maybe why the bear in the film didn't necessarily work so well. What a lost opportunity. Those are really fun characters. I listened to X-Men podcast, Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, and Miles Stokes called The New Mutants film surprisingly okay. And Jay edited and said something like, I think most people would disagree with you about it. And when the weird outlier hot take about your movie is that it's not that bad, yeesh. One thing that I didn't mention that I think is really interesting about doing kind of threatening bear scenarios is, of course, the idea that the most dangerous animal is like the mother bear protecting her young. So there's a really great kind of shocking moment that you can do in a wilderness adventure where you find not the mother bear, but the two little bear cubs. And if you find the two little bear cubs, then you realize the mother bear must be around somewhere, and she probably thinks that you're menacing her young. And you can extrapolate, and because this is such like a well-known behavior of bears, you can put this on other monsters. So if you have like an owl bear, and you find like two little adorable downy owlet-looking little owl bear chicks, you look at them and you're like, oh, who's a little snufty? And then you suddenly realize, well, wait a minute, this means mom is around. And then you hear the hoot roar from the woods. This is particularly enjoyable to do to a low-level party because they won't feel like they lost a fight. Avoiding a hazard isn't the same thing as losing a fight. The owlbear's not gonna talk trash or like murder innocent people if you don't beat them. So you don't really feel bad just going, owlbear, run! And then you all flee. Particularly because if the owlbear's goal is to protect the eggs, then, you know, presumably once you get to a safe distance, it won't pursue you any further. So I think that there's fun that can be had with that. You know, because humans have this long connection to bears, we have feelings about bears that maybe are not, and maybe indeed bears are the wild animal that we have the most connection to. Obviously, domestic animals like cats and dogs, we have very, very strong emotional bonds to. But for wild animals, it may be the bear. Like, I don't know if there's an equivalent of something like Fat Bear Week for any other species. And because of that attachment, we have a wide range of different myths and different folklore about them. Those myths and folklore can be adapted easily because the players also have some kind of emotional connection to bears, even if they've never actually seen a live bear in its habitat. Okay, that is about all the bears that we have time for today. Chris, thank you once again very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Chris and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Next week, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.